Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host Tom Coyne. And today we've got special guest joining us. It's James Paul Luna from Entranced. Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, what's up, guys? Glad to be here.
Thank you. Appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk with us on your commute home. We appreciate that. So congratulations on the brand new album. And I don't want to pronounce it. But I'm going to let you pronounce it for me because I might mess it up.
Okay. Muerte y metal. Which it means death and metal in Spanish.
Okay. I just had to look that up earlier today and find that out because I wasn't actually sure. But now I know. So, yeah. But congratulations on the new record. It's great. Tom and I really enjoy it. He turned me on to it, and I right away went and ordered it and been enjoying it since. But, yeah, it's great. So you want to start, Tom, and talk about some Entranced stuff?
Absolutely. First of all, there was a band called Fortress that I was into pre- Entranced. And so when I got the first Entranced album, I saw that the guitar player, Philly Bibbiano, was in Entranced. So if you could tell me how you guys got together and how the whole Entranced project came about.
Well, I guess I'll take a step back because I was looking for a new project. Holy Grail was at a standstill. And when 2020 happened and the world was like exploding, imploding. I decided like, you know what, like we need to put this to bed, and I just stepped away from it. And then everyone's like, yeah, let's stop. And so I was looking for a new project, and I wanted to do something kind of adding some more hard rock and maybe adding like some Spanish lyrics into it. Cause my family's from Mexico and it's part of my heritage. So I wanted to incorporate some of that. And I'm buddies with the Fortress guys, and they were looking. They had trouble with their singer, and they're saying, hey, do you want to sing some shows for us or like join the band? Or like, we got this offer for a tour. And I'm like, hold on. Like how many bands are named Fortress out there? Like, what? Like, I don't know. I think I want to start something new instead. And so like, yeah, let's just start a new band then. And so we started a new band, and that was with Ben, the drummer of Fortress, and Philly, the like main songwriter, shredder of Fortress. And that was the beginnings. It was just the three of us doing Entranced, and then we got a buddy to play bass for some tours. And then does that answer your question?
Yeah.
That's okay. A start for sure.
Okay,
so the idea, I mean, at least what my ears were hearing, it the actually that on the second album, which we won't get to yet, but I there were a number of songs that kind of reminded me a little bit of the early White Wizard stuff. It was more in that catchier, maybe a little catchier and not as heavy as the Holy Grail material was. Was that your intent to take it more like from like real heavy metal to more of like a traditional hard rock catchier song intent?
Yeah, I guess it wasn't really that intention, but it was like the sound from our EP. It was a lot of, I think there was two songs were like, one song was mine, and then another song was like a riff I had that combined in the jam session that we fleshed it out with Philly and Ben and myself. And then the other two or three were like all Philly's ideas that he kind of had laying around that we like kind of scraped together. And then I put like melodies and lyrics on all of them. And Ben and I are like kind of like the lyricists for the band. And so that when that all came together, it's like, okay, this is kind of the sound. It's not like thrashy. It's not like fully modern production. It maybe has modern aesthetics a little bit, but we really want to keep it like old school, like early Scorpions and Rainbow and UFO and a little bit of Thin Lizzy. And yeah, that was kind of the vibe. And we also love this band, Rata Blanca from Argentina. It's like a Argentine kind of old school
really?
Power metal.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard that name before. So the term, the new wave of traditional heavy metal, how do you feel about that? Is that something that you kind of like strive for? You're happy, proud of it? Or like you said, it's something you don't even consider? You just say, hey, I like these bands. I like Thin Lizzy. I like Scorpions and stuff. Is that kind of how you look at it? Or is it like you say, hey, you know, I'm this younger guy. I want to do this new wave of traditional heavy metal thing. Is that, you kind of like look at it that way at all?
To be honest, I didn't really, but it's hard to not say there's like a movement happening of that. And that it's like, if you have like any kind of metal looking guitars or stage clothing and have a riff that's kind of distorted and kind of maybe has a twin lead at some point, then you'll like kind of end up in that
right.
subgenre.
Sure. Yeah. That's true.
But I mean, the New Album movement to begin with was like a really cool mix of like anywhere from like AOR to like hard rock to kind of like a little bit of new wave. Like there, it was so like vast, and like just because they were from England from like 77 to like 84, they were like all kind of lumped into one, you know. But now it's like with the new wave of traditional heavy metal movement, it's like it's worldwide, and it's like very varied. But I think it's okay. We kind of like we're very tongue in cheek about it, and we said we're part of the Latino album or movement, which is the Latin traditional heavy metal movement. But I don't think the name stuck.
Yeah.
Well, that is true about the original new wave of British heavy metal. It was, to this day, I'm still finding bands that, and I grew up in that era of when all that stuff came out, and I thought I knew every band, and there were so many bands that today, there's all these reissue out companies in Europe that are putting out all the stuff that wasn't signed. And so much of it is, I'm always telling Mark, you got to check this. All these bands from like 80, 81 that I never heard of before. It was just such a deluge of great music in that period of time. It was incredible. I don't think we'll ever see anything quite like that again.
Yeah. No, it was, and it's all like private press or like just,
right.
You know, one take, one or two takes, like kind of live tracked.
Yeah.
They go, you know, they pitch their money to like go tracked for a day.
Exactly.
And bang out as many songs as they got. So you also had to be really good at your instruments then, you know, there was no like,
exactly.
You couldn't fix it in Pro Tools.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, I guess maybe we'll like press 100 single 7-inches because it was cheap. And then that's all that right. existed.
Right. And now that stuff is finally getting, a lot of it's getting reissued on CD.
But it all kind of had like a punk rock ethos and like kind of a DIY punk rock energy behind it that I really love.
Yeah, me too. I can't have any new wave of British heavy metal conversation without asking you who your favorite band of the movement was.
I like this band. Well, there's a couple Prowlers, but there's this one band called Prowler that's got a single called like Forgotten Angel. It's really hard to come by. I still haven't found it. I found their other one, but it's like $500 and up if you can find those things.
Wow.
I know the band you're talking about. Yeah.
And I really love Parallax. They have like, I think Lars put out a comp of like new album and he had a couple tracks on that, but they do like Black Widow and White Lightning and stuff like that. But probably it's really hard to pass up Diamond Head though. That's kind of like the one that sticks with me most.
That's mine.
Yeah. Okay.
Diamond Head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was the best band of the whole movement.
Yeah. I actually was chatting Yeah, I was actually chatting with Sean Harris on Instagram not too long ago.
Really?
And I thought he was just like, he had disappeared from the face of the earth.
Really? How the hell did you find him on Instagram? Like, yeah.
He's just like posting videos and old clips of Diamond Head on Instagram. I'm like, is this really you?
Right.
He's like, yeah, it's me, mate. How you doing? I'm like, what the hell? Yeah, he's on there and he replies.
You know, they went through a period of time, just to digress on them for a minute. They were being touted as the next Zeppelin. And if you listen to that, I was just listening to them the other day. They had that vibe. Like, his voice had at times a plant-like quality to it. And the songwriting was so, the riffs were so strong. They were just incredible band. And it's just amazing that he, who was looked at as the main guy in that scene for a while, just vanished.
Yeah. I think when a band gets blown up to a certain level and like you get to be like, oh, the next Led Zeppelin or something, that right. that's like a big, a heavy weight to carry.
It's a kiss
on.
Of death. Absolutely.
It's a heavy weight on your shoulders.
Right. It's like an athlete who's told he's the next Michael Jordan, or it's a kiss of death. So I wanted to talk about the new Entranced album, which to me, I like the debut. The new one, I really thought the songs were kicked up a notch. And I thought the songwriting is terrific on a couple of songs in particular I wanted to talk to you about. Did you find on this second album now that as a band you were more like cohesive and the songwriting even took another jump up? Because that's what my ears heard.
Thank you. Yeah, I think this was like we had had some touring under our belt and we jammed more of these ideas and just like it was more of a collaborative, like this, let's like fine tune all the bits and pieces together. Whereas the first EP was like kind of some ideas we had and we like threw them together to make, put out a record to be able to go on tour. And I think I really love that first EP too, but the album, yeah, like we put a lot of energy and effort into like really crafting all the songs and like really taking our time. I think we were even late, like a month and a half to deliver it to the label just because we wanted to really dial it in and like make sure all the pieces were like in order, you know? And also like, I think cause we were like tweaking on the artwork too. Yeah. To be fully honest,
right,
which is always happens.
So do you feel like with Philly you have like a collaboration that you could see, you know, blossoming for a long period of time now?
Yeah, Philly and I work really well together, and then it's great, like him and I like musically are like really in sync, and I think we're, after working on that EP, then like for the album we were starting to kind of get like each other's vibe on like when to leave room for the vocals or when like how to transition stuff and like kind of what ranges work for each other.
Now the idea of putting the Spanish lyrics, which I happen to like, me and Mark were into a band with that Roy Z had a number of years ago.
Tribe of Gypsies.
I don't know that.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh boy. You got to hear Tribe of Gypsies. I think they have like, what, 5 albums out?
Yeah.
Yeah. Roy Z was the guitar player in it, you know, who produced a lot of the Bruce Dickinson stuff. And it was his band. And it was an all-Latino band also that had some mixture of American vocals and Spanish vocals. And we were both huge fans of it. And this reminded me of that album. When you were getting that idea, were there influences like, we could make this work with a cut, or was it just like, let's take a shot with it and see, you know, how it goes down?
Yeah, for me, it's usually the way lyrics come about. I usually start with like a melody, maybe like kind of putting some phrases together and scatting some words that kind of are like gibberish and nonsense that kind of become words. And then so with this through, it's like, okay, like with this, does this feel like a Spanish lyric, a hybrid, and I would just kind of take it song by song. It wasn't like pre-planned. It was just kind of like as it unfolded kind of on its own.
Okay. That's interesting with the gibberish lyrics, because we did a podcast a number of months back with the drummer from Badlands, and he was talking about how Ray Gillen used to write a lot of songs, and they would go into the studio on the second Badlands album, and he said a lot of it were just like melodies with like gibberish lyrics that he would start off with, and it would start to like come together, which I'm sure you're a big fan of Ray Gillen, but that's what he used to do. And like you're saying it right now, it's the second time I've heard somebody refer to writing like that. It's interesting.
Yeah, I guess I've also like just in the course of like reading a lot of seeing like VH1 Behind the Music or reading a lot of musicians' biographies, it's pretty common that people do that. Okay. I think Michael Jackson would do it.
Really?
And he would even like have these tape recordings where he would like beatbox and like hum like all the different instruments. Like Danny Elfman even does that for all his orchestral stuff. Like,
I didn't know that.
And it's like all kind of stuff, and then it like gets put together. So yeah, I didn't know that either, but I thought I was weird, but now I feel less weird that I know other people do that.
Yeah, too. I didn't realize, because the first time I ever heard about that was when we had this Badlands show on, and the drummer was talking about that. That's how Ray Gillen would come into the studio with ideas like melodies and whatnot, but not really have clear lyrics. Then he referred to it as what you did, as gibberish, and then they would put the lyrics together that actually, I guess, made some semblance of sense. So I wanted to ask you about a couple of songs, like Lady Lightning is one of my favorites.
Oh, that's
on
a great one.
Great song. Yeah. How did a little bit about the writing process and how that came about?
I'm trying to think back to like its working title.
I totally like
how that one.
I hear Saxon. Was that an influence there?
That's interesting. Like, cause it does, now that you say that, it does kind of have a Saxon vibe. I think I was kind of going for somewhere in that world of like Saxon and Dio.
Okay.
But the song itself, like that riff, is just like so, like I just, when I heard it and like the feeling I got, it felt like very electrifying, and the words like kept giving me like this like kind of thunder and lightning, that kind of those phrasing kept coming up when I was like working on melodies. And so I sat with Ben and we kind of planned out like, okay, what if it's like this romance with this like supernatural, like goddess of lightning in the sky. And it's like kind of this interplay lyrically on words like that. And then we just kind of add it like a very like Dio approach to the whole thing. And that's kind of how that one unfolded. That one like got written pretty fast.
Okay.
I think it was just like, this one's fun. And we just like ran with it.
Nice.
What about Switchblade? Another favorite of mine.
Okay. So they, interestingly enough, Switchblade was a song that I wrote with James LaRue at the, like, it was one of the very last songs that we were like working on to after the first White Wizard EP. And then we tried to use it for, Holy Grail, but it didn't quite fit the musical style. And then so I was talking with James LaRue. I'm like, hey, like, what do you think of this song? Like, I want to re-record it and kind of do it again. He's like, that's great. And then we asked him to play it. So he's playing guitar on that song as well, and he's the guest leads on that, and like does little like noodles in between like some of the verses and stuff. So yeah, that song's from like 2000, I don't even know when that would be, 2008 or 2009.
Wow.
That was one of
maybe
the songs.
2007 even.
When I said to you earlier on, it kind of, the sound of Entranced at times reminds me of the very early incarnation of White Wizard. And that was one of the songs that I was referring to, because it's got that vibe. It's of that first White Wizard EP.
That's funny, because that's like straight out of that era.
Yeah,
like 2007. I don't remember when we stopped doing White Wizard and when we started Holy Grail. I think it was maybe 2007.
Yeah, 07, 08, around there.
Yeah.
My favorite song on the album is I Don't Know Nothing.
Oh, cool.
Could tell us a little bit about that.
So that one, we were playing we didn't have a solid, like, full member of bassist yet, but Nico, we were like jamming with him. We did a couple shows. And so we said, you know what? We think this is the guy, like, let's ask him. And so we went and saw, he's from Argentina, and we went and saw the World Cup. The day Argentina wins the World Cup, it's like, oh my God, like, this is amazing. We had planned to have a jam session that day, and we were all like really excited. And then we asked him, hey, like, can you, you want to join the band? And he's like, oh, absolutely. Like, what better day to like start, join a band than the day Argentina wins the World Cup. And Philly had just a little lick that he started playing. They're like, oh, what is that? Let's jam on that for a while. And that was like, we jammed for like maybe 45 minutes and kind of laid down like the basic structure of what became I Don't Know Nothing. And it's kind of like an inside joke for us, where we would just say this, like, I don't know nothing. And and so we're like, dude, what was that? What was that song that you just played? Like, what was that riff? And Philly was like, I don't know nothing. And so that's where I got the idea for the title, but I kind of turned it into like this whole philosophical story that Ben helped me with kind of shape. Ben's like really, he's like well-studied, went to Ivy League school. He's like really clever and like really smart with like grammar and literature mm-hmm. and like kind of phrasing and poetry. So we work well off of each other. And it's like this kind of philosophical, like, not getting like too big for your bridges, or also just like being really like a worker amongst workers and like one against many. And just like, I don't think I need to know everything. Like, I can just be and like live and like enjoy life, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I would say if I got to pick a favorite song, that would be the one on the new album. Absolutely.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And it opens like with a really cool kind of, we wanted to start with a lead, like very, awesome. Like, yeah. And Philly just crushes it on the lead.
That's the first thing that grabbed me was that. It was such really ass kicking.
It's like very Schenker.
Yes, absolutely. You know, like. Yes. Yeah.
I would say if I had to pick one, it might be Lady Lightning. But there's one I wanted to ask you about, the last track on the album, See You on the Other Side. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. That's interesting because
it's such that an epic song, track.
Yeah, thank you. That is like a song that I'd kind of messed around with on acoustic guitar for a while, and I had pitched to the guys like the night before. Like, nobody had heard it yet, and the night before we're gonna start tracking drums. We already had 9 other songs that we were gonna work on. Mm-hmm. I said, guys, I think we could fit this in the record somewhere. I think we have enough time to like fit this idea in. And they're like, what do you mean? Like, we're tracking tomorrow and like we've never heard this song. and it's like, well, if we work on it, just like, let's just try it. And so it was a song that I've kind of written around like loss of like several like people that are close to me, and just like grief and loss and just kind of the heartbreak, but also like the sadness and also the beauty of it. And so I put that into a song, very like kind of channeling early like Scorpions, you know, like Taken by Force kind of era Scorpions. And so we tried it, and it worked out, and it kind of came together pretty nicely. And I think Philly's leads on it were really cool. And kind of takes it back to that kind of like Blackmore, Uli John Roth kind of guitar playing.
Yeah. No, it's one of them songs. Like, the first time I heard it, I just kind of picked up on it. I had to keep listening again and again, because I'm like, this is a pretty epic track. I'm like, I'm really digging this.
Yeah. Thank you.
Talking about the Scorpions, I just want to ask you a question. Seeing that you're considerably younger than myself, maybe not so much Mark, but were the Scorpions a band that you had to discover there was a whole nother side of them before the American market? Because back in the day when I was growing up, when they broke the American market, I knew about them, but virtually nobody knew that they had like six albums out that never made it into the United States. Were you exposed just to like, you know, Rock You Like a Hurricane and you had to find out about the Scorpions, or you were already plugged in from the beginning that there was a whole other side of them from the 70s?
Yeah. So, like kind of towards the end of high school and like in the beginning of like junior college, when I was like maybe 18, 19, I started jamming with guys that were like a lot older than me, like 13 years older. And they were like, they were actually both from Buffalo and like had played in a bunch of bands, but then moved to San Francisco, then moved to LA. So, and they always worked at record stores and were always like metalheads. And so they knew a lot of like old school hard rock and like AOR, and like they're even also into a lot of like old school funk and early hip hop. But they would always turn me on to like weirdo obscure stuff. But one day we went to rehearse like down in our spot, and we're just kind of getting ready. And then one of the dudes puts, my buddy Chris Nabb, he puts on this tape. And I just hear this guitar playing, like sounds insane. I'm like, what is happening right now? And it was Dark Lady, and it was like in the Entranced record. I was like, this is not like, how is this the Scorpions? Yeah. Like, this is not Rock You Like a Hurricane or Still Loving You. Like, what is happening right now?
Although you did have Yuli's vocals on that, which weren't the greatest, but the guitar playing was insane.
Yeah. and then like Robot Man and like Top of the Bill and like Entranced, like that whole record just blew my mind. I was like, okay, like this is some music.
Catch a Train. I mean, was there a more insane song like that when that was recorded in 77? I mean, nobody doing stuff like that in 77.
No, it was so over the top. But yeah, that's similarly like just hearing stuff like, because I grew up like metalheads, and where I grew up in the suburbs, like in the 90s, they were into like, you know, like Disturbed and Slipknot and like Stained and like all stuff that I was like, I don't know if that's my vibe. Because I grew up on like Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, like
those
classic rock, hard rock, kind of like early hard rock, early metal. And always loved that stuff. And then there's groups from Mexico too, like Los Dug Dugs and but anyway, so for me, that modern metal of the 90s, I just didn't connect with. And like even Metallica was kind of like turned into like some, you know, they were like Load. It was just like a different world of Metallica. Like, I don't know. And then I eventually got turned on to like, oh yeah, like Kill 'Em All and Ride the Lightning. Like, that's the real shit. And then like Judas Priest and Merciful Fate and Manowar, and then like Scorpions and Trance. I'm like, oh, okay. Like, this is the real metal that I've been looking for, you know? And then of course like Rainbow and Dio and Maiden. And yeah, it kind of all like unfolded there. Like as I got deeper into like record collecting.
Nice.
Were you a big Sabotage fan?
Sabotage?
Yeah.
Yeah. I like them actually. I still haven't seen Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and they're coming through this week. I try and see that.
Yeah, that was like, one of my real big favorites from the year, especially the early incarnation, the 80s, the 80s incarnation, when Chris Oliva was still alive. That I thought that they were Head and Shoulders. There were a couple of bands from that, Fifth Angel, Crimson Glory, obviously Queensryche, you know, goes without saying. Vicious Rumors with Carl Albert before he died.
Oh yeah, Vicious Rumors is cool.
Vicious Rumors was the late 80s, very early 90s stuff was just incredible. That stuff to me just set the pace for really there was so those bands to me were Head and Shoulders above a lot of the, you know, the hair bands and whatnot. They were just on another, the first two Fifth Angel albums. I don't know if you ever got into those guys from Seattle.
I think I've heard them, but I maybe on comps, but I don't think I've actually like listened to whole albums. So
it's the first Fifth Angel is considered like a, especially in Europe, like a power metal classic of all time. Should check it out.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. So we want to go back to Entrance. What are the plans going forward? Touring? What lays ahead?
Well, right now it's kind of holiday season. Different people are leaving town and such, but we're still kind of working on new tunes, Billy and I, and kind of shaping what's going to be the next album, and in the background, kind of working on logistics and planning for some touring in late spring, early summer of 2025. And then hopefully we start to record this second album or second full length later in the year, next year. And no plans for like a release date or anything like that yet. But I mean, I wouldn't say we're like as active as Holy Grail was, where we would tour like 9 months out of the year and stuff, and like really road dog it, because we all have like families and jobs. But like, I think we're still trying to do like some choice, like at least 3 or 4 tours a year, and put out record every year, every other year, like, and we'll like, and like see where it goes. But I'm interested to see what happens, like going to Europe next year, because we have some cool shows lined up.
That's the place to be.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think you'll do real well there.
Yeah. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
So if you could indulge us for a little bit, we do want to go back to, how did you get into music on a professional level? Your first band being White Wizard, which was one of the very first bands of this new wave of traditional heavy metal movement. In fact, it was the first band that I stumbled upon way back when it came out. I saw it on YouTube, I guess, 2007, 2008. How did you meet the guys in that band, and how did that whole thing get off the ground?
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, that band I was talking about that I was in with older guys, like we were looking for a bass player, and that was in like maybe 2004, 2005, that we were looking for a bassist, and our guitarist found John Leon on like a classifieds ad on Craigslist. And it's like, it said something like Cliff Burton meets Steve Harris, something like that. And he's like, all right, let's check this guy out. And we jammed, and it's like sounded great. And that was a band called Jet Fuel, which there's some videos on the internet. It's funny. It's kind of like, we were like a weird melting pot. Like, we really loved like the sweet and Witchfinder General and this 70s band called Stray. But like, people just didn't get it, because we're kind of doing like hard rock, but a little bit of like kind of slightly like new album, but also a little bit trying to add a little bit of like glittery, like glam, like sweet or angel to it. And like, it just didn't, it was wow. Like a weird melting pot. And that project kind of fell apart. And then the drummer and John Leon, the drummer Tyler Meal and John Leon and myself ended up like reconnecting. And John had found this guy who was actually had been in this band called Huntress in San Diego with this gal, Jill Janis. But they were like, that project had split up, but it was like traditional metal. And so we started playing, and that was like the beginning of White Wizard. It was like from the get-go, John was like very adamant. It's like, I want it to sound like Judas Priest and Iron Maiden and like old school, like metal and Scorpions. And I was like, all right, cool. Like, we're all into that stuff. So let's just try and do music like that. And then that's what became White Wizard.
And the songs that were on that EP, you participated in the songwriting? Was you and Leon were the main writers, or LaRue also?
I think Leon had like some riff, like concept ideas for a few of those. James LaRue was a very prolific writer, and he put together a lot of like the nuts and bolts of it. The one song that I wrote completely was High Speed GTO, and I brought that to the group. The rest were all kind of a collaborative effort. And then all the lyrics I wrote on like in a weekend trip, I went with my girlfriend at the time to Hawaii, and I wrote all the lyrics like in Hawaii, in Maui, like just like on a Saturday afternoon, and then came back and sang them the next week.
Wow.
Did you write Octane Gypsy?
No, that was a John Leon idea, but the lyrics, I kind of worked with John on those.
Yeah, that was my favorite. I would say that and Celestina were my two favorites on that album.
Yeah, Celestina was really fun.
That album had some great, in some respects, I hold it a little different from the rest because it, to me, it had a very unique sound. Like for everything they did post when you were in the band, which I liked it, but it was very, very Maiden. Like as the albums progressed, it was just, you know, it was just total Maiden worship, especially the bass playing. And yeah. The first album really didn't have that. It was like very unique sounding. I don't know whether it was your vocals, whether it was like that overdone Maiden thing really hadn't set in with him yet. But I always to this day found that EP just kind of like had a special part. And again, I liked everything he put out with that band, all the different singers and everything. But I always thought that first album had a special sound to it. And it wasn't so over the top, you know, Steve Harris worship, which is what it kind of became. What good songs and good singing. I'm not knocking it at all. But I thought that EP was very, when you look back on that, is it something you look back with fondness or like, you know?
Yeah. You know, I hadn't like listened to it in a while and also like in great detail in a while. But like I said, I had earlier before this call, like I had a jam with Tyler, the original drummer, and John Leon, and then Chad and Eric Kluber from like the second Mach 2 White Wizard guitar right. players.
Right.
Because we're trying to get a reunion, a White Wizard reunion together. It ended up falling apart, but we did have a couple jam sessions and it sounded great just to like replay those songs from the EP again. Mm-hmm. We just played the whole EP and I was like, whoa, like these were like, we really did a great job.
And it had a great production too. It had a huge production. Yeah. It would be something I think of interest to a lot of people if you could get that off the ground. But I mean, you know, I don't know what the likelihood of that.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe in a year or two, we'll revisit it.
So then you left after that EP. Was that an amicable break? Was it you just figured you wanted to do your own thing? Or what led to such a quick break after an EP?
I think me and Tyler, I think I'll just speak for myself, really. I think I was just young and just like, I was like, okay, we did the old school thing. Like, I want to do like more thrash or like sound like Trouble or like bring in other elements to this and like bring some more shred to it or something. I just wanted to level it up. And John really wanted to keep it old school, which I get. But like, I think just being young in my 20s, I'm like, no, I want to like spread my wings and like go crazy. And it probably wasn't as clean or as amicable as I would have liked. Mm-hmm. And we were just like, okay, we're just going to go start this other band. We just kind of like left and just started writing new songs that were more like twin lead, like added more like Yngwie Malmsteen and like kind of Megadeth kind of riffing into it, which like that neoclassical kind of shred thrash was what became like Holy Grail.
And how did you meet Eli Santana?
Eli came through a mutual friend of James LaRue, and Eli had a mutual friend who's our buddy Seth, who's a shredder down in San Diego. And he also is like a guitar teacher, but he kind of came up in like the San Diego shred scene with LaRue and Eli, and he's like, oh, you should hit up Eli, because he's like kind of back and forth through LA, and so we hit him up, and he was like really down to earth, great guy, and shreds on guitar, and like he was able to like do all the parts and like harmonize with LaRue, and so like, okay, like this is awesome, let's do this.
Now Holy Grail was a completely different beast than White Wizard. I mean, it was
markedly
different. I mean, I remember I came across My Last Attack, I guess when the album first came out, and I didn't even know you were in the band. And then when I saw the video, I recognized you, and it was way heavier, faster, aggressive sound than White Wizard. So was that was the approach that you felt like with this band you were going to stay the course with that? Because pretty much, I think, for the most part, all three albums were of that much more aggressive stance.
Yeah, I think we wanted to just go balls out and just go as fast and extreme and like power metal thrash, but right. like have a bit of like the old school, still have like, for me, like, I think even on that first album, there's a song called Chase the Wind, which is, oh my God, why am I blanking on that band? But it was like, it was a nod to like a, there's a couple of nods, even like Hollow Ground was a nod to the Hollow Ground new album band. But like there's subtle nods to new album and like a lot of the kind of structure of new wave of British heavy metal had like very kind of pop sensibilities, mm-hmm. kind of how like you can even say like Venom or Motorhead just had like pop structures, but they were just played like aggressive and the voices like heavier or gravelly, you know? And so we kind of added some of that pop sensibility of like the new wave of British heavy metal movement. And then like added just a bunch of like power metal and thrash in the mix.
So. Well, that was the essence of 80s Motorhead. 80s Motorhead, if you listen to the songs, they were really, for the most part, really commercial songs, just played really heavy with a gruff vocal. But he wrote throughout the whole 80s, the songs were so catchy and well written and almost poppy in terms of the delivery of them. It was just the sound of them and his voice that made it sound heavier than it really was.
Oh yeah, totally.
A lot of that stuff was, you know, like Orgasmatron and you know.
Oh yeah.
That's like my favorite Motorhead album. I know a lot of people are like wishy-washy with it, but the songs on that album were just so catchy and commercial. And I think Holy Grail did maintain that too. I don't think you really tipped it to the point it was heavy just for the sake of being heavy. It still had, you know, really good, beefy, strong song structure to it.
Yeah.
So
that was kind of the intention, I guess.
Yeah. Now, you did three albums with the band. I mean, I have the Japanese copies. I know you did a lot of covers, like an Accept cover, Priest cover, a Rainbow cover. Were those three of your favorite bands pre becoming a professional musician?
Yeah, I would say. And we also did a very early on in our like first few tours, we covered a Trouble song, The Wolf by Trouble. We never recorded that one though, but
interesting.
Yeah, that was another big influence.
I would have liked to seen that thrown on a B-side or something.
Yeah.
So I was talking to you before we went on the air. I saw an early incarnation of Holy Grail, and then I saw you, I think, on the third album, and I think it was toward the end of the tour. What led to the demise of that band?
I think a few things. We, after the second album, like there was certain expectations from labels, like in Europe, and you like, we weren't hitting certain numbers, and then like tour support started dwindling, but then also like inner band dynamics and management kind of shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I came to realize like why so many bands that I love from the 70s, like only lasted one or two records, you know, like the awesome obscure bands that mm-hmm. like have like one or two records and then that's it. And it's like, oh wow, like this is probably why. Because it's like when things start to take off and then there's like more people with like, you know, another fingers in the pudding or whatever, you know, a lot of cooks in the kitchen and the band dynamics and like the egos and everything, it's like it was just kind of getting out of control. And it was taking a toll on all of us. So we like took a pause and then came back and made the third record, but it was still not quite meeting people's expectations. And then the label we were on was like really like letting go of bands and like trying to sell and like didn't have much funding. And we missed some pretty big touring opportunities without our knowledge that really bummed us out. Mm. And in Europe, like, yeah, somebody made a decision to not take us on these tours without asking us. They made it on these decisions on our behalf. And it would have been with like Amon Amarth and Carcass and stuff, you know, like just, it was, would have been some pretty big tours, but, and we're like, we just kind of got, I think overall, like the morale was just so low. And we did some really great tours, but still like, it wasn't like kind of getting it back. And like the momentum just kind of like slowed down. And then eventually when 2020 hit, I was like, okay, I think there's like just, it's so low right now. I think we just need to put it to bed, maybe revisit it like down the road, but like, I can't do this right now.
Mm. Does the road, when you're with a band now, like three times over, does the road and being on the road for long periods of time start to play into a longevity of a band sometimes?
I think it can, but it, just from seeing and talking to other fellow musicians and other like touring buddies, like it also just really depends on like the personalities and chemistry. And also like when we started Holy Grail, like we were like a lot of us like in our early mid 20s, and then like after like in 2020, like we were like in our mid to late 30s, you know, so it was just like a totally different, like we're like, you're a different kind of person. Mm-hmm. Than you were, we were when we were just like, you know, young, dumb, and full of cum, as they say. You know?
Right. Now, that's where I was kind of going with it, because when you're with a band for, you know, three albums, three tours, there's usually a passage of 6, 7, 8 years, which you're under each other's feet a lot, and then guys start to grow in different directions or have different. Does that element play into sometimes bands dissolving?
Yeah, and I think it also, like, because we all kind of grew into different realms and kind of became, like, different, involved with, like, different life stuff and didn't see each other as much or didn't hang out as much, and unless it was, like, a band thing. So, yeah, it just kind of just became a different dynamic, you know.
I know Eli has started to get big in, like, I started seeing, like, adverts for him and, you know, the magazines and... Like his guitar playing seemed to have grown in stature as a name shredder.
Oh yeah. I mean, and even now, like Eli is running a band Ignite as a singer. And,
I didn't know that. Like, I know that band.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's been their lead singer the last, few years.
I didn't know he could sing. Could he sing?
Oh yeah.
He can.
Yeah. Okay. He did backing vocals for Holy Grail stuff.
I didn't know that he could front a band. Interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah. Because I remember that he started to become.
He's killing it.
You know, I've seen pictures of him in magazines and adverts and stuff. He started to be. When I first saw Holy Grail, which was toward the beginning, he had great stage presence. I remember you guys at that Knitting Factory show went into a great crowd. The place was packed. The two of you went into the crowd and. You know, he had the hair and he had the perfect look. There were so many chicks like all over him as he's playing. I'm like, this guy has got the whole thing going on. It's the whole package.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, he's killing it with Ignite. I think they've done two records with him, and it's great.
Do you ever see yourself at some point working with him again, or even anything or is Entrance like your tunnel vision right now?
I'm not opposed to working with Eli or any of the guys. Like I still talk to all the Holy Grail guys. Like we get along, and I think maybe we'll give it some time and see like how to do something again. There's like just like for instance, like the first tour that Holy Grail did was with 3 Inches of Blood, and then to hear that like 3 Inches of Blood like did start doing reunions again after 8 years, and that they're back together. It's kind of like, oh, well, maybe we could do something like that, like after a few years or something. Actually, Entrance is going to play those shows with 3 Inches of Blood over here in Southern California, which will be really cool. But so that is another thing on the horizon, is some shows with 3 Inches of Blood that we're really looking forward to.
How is the club scene in the area of California where you're at right now?
LA is really spread out. There's a lot of clubs. There's a lot of shows, similar to like New York, you know, or the East Coast, even in Jersey. Like there's a lot of shows, you know, but over here it's kind of spread out, and there's like little pockets of scenes,
right,
within scenes. But yeah, there is starting to be a little scene of like old school metal, but now there is like a resurgence of like kind of grunge-esque bands. But I say grunge-esque because they say they're grunge, but like, I don't know, like Alice in Chains and Nirvana could actually play their instruments well. So I don't know.
Right. Well,
it's like a watering down grunge,
right?
You know,
right.
It's like Soundgarden and Pearl Jam. Like they can actually,
those guys were all really good players actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's like a lot of young, you know, guys playing like what they're calling grunge and like doing like a grunge revival scene, but, and it's like really taking off. Like people are going to see the shows.
Wow.
But like, it's just kind of like the musicianship is not very strong, which kind of confuses me. So maybe I'm too old for it now.
Well, even back in the day, there were two levels of grunge bands, and there were a lot of those type of bands back in the day. And then you had the guys that like Alice in Chains, who really were a band that were pretty big even when hair metal was still big. Their first album came out like 89, 90-ish. And then there were the bands that, yeah, the musicianship was definitely a drop off of what guys like us are used to and expect. But in this area, it's still Brooklyn. That's the big area for the metal bands. And it's a really thriving scene. That's why I hope, you know, maybe you'll come back again with Entrance. Have you done, well, I think you said off the air, you did do an East Coast date with Entrance.
Yeah, we played Brooklyn. I forgot the name of the venue, but with Haunt and Seven Sisters in 2022.
Okay. Yeah, I missed that.
Where were you?
That year I just moved out here, and I, you know, also now where I'm living, when I lived in Staten Island, we used to be able to get to those Brooklyn shows like in 40 minutes. I used to go with my girlfriend a lot. And now that we're out here, it's closer to 2 hours to get down to Brooklyn. So,
Yeah.
So like, I don't really have my eye on, cause there was a band from, Canada. I don't know if you remember them, called Cauldron.
Yeah.
I used to go see, I was a huge fan of that. I must have saw them in Brooklyn like 4 or 5. In fact, I saw them open for Diamond Head one time. I used to go see them every time they played down there. But now I'm a little bit more selective because it's such a big trip. And then you come out, you have a 2-hour trip ahead of you at home. So, but I would come out to see you if you showed up down there. I just didn't know about that show 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think that was the beginning of like that whole movement. Like before White Wizard, it was Cauldron and Enforcer, and the Lord Weird Slaufeg is kind of in that world too, right. You know? And interestingly enough, one of the first like handful of shows, actually the first show we played in San Francisco as Holy Grail, was in San Francisco with, it was, we opened, then it was Cauldron, then it was Slaufeg, and then Enforcer closed the night out. It was crazy. And in like 100-person venue, like 100-cap room, like packed out. It was awesome. Wow.
That's what I used to enjoy about those Brooklyn shows. It reminded me of the metal scene in Brooklyn at Lamore's and the Cat Club back in the day, where they played these small places and they would get jammed and everybody was sweating and there was so much energy from the crowd and the band. To me, that's like the perfect show. And I saw a lot of shows down there. Like, you know, I saw Stryker a couple of times And they have a tremendous energy too. And it's I kind of miss those type of shows.
Oh yeah. You mentioned Vicious Rumors. Like, Dan from Stryker is obsessed with Vicious Rumors. He said that was like what got him into singing, was just like, I think he was working like a delivery job or something, and he would just put on Vicious Rumors and just sing along. And it's like, oh, I could sing. Like,
well, I'll tell you a funny story about that. I used to be friends with one of the guitar players, not in the band anymore. And we were talking about influences and everything. And I just mentioned, because some of their songs remind me of Vicious Rumors. And he said to me, he said, Dan, he goes, he's like obsessed with them. So I was going to go see them that night. And I have like a whole bunch of old vintage Vicious Rumors t-shirts. And I wore one and I was standing in front and they hit the stage. You know, sooner hit the stage, he saw the shirt and he's like pointing to me like that and going like that. And yeah, that's how I knew he was like a nut for Vicious Rumors.
Yeah, that's cool.
So
I forgot to mention a band that you're probably familiar with that is also a huge influence on the band is Riot.
Ah.
Well, yeah, we had a Riot show with one of the original, he wasn't original, but like one of the core members, Rick Ventura, from the classic lineup. Rick was on Fire Down Under and Made in America. Awesome. Well, yeah, that whole lineup. We had him on the show about 2 years ago. And we had Tony Moore on just recently, who was the singer in Thundersteel and Privilege of Power.
Oh, wow. I got to hear that interview.
Yeah, look for it. That was only, what? A month or two ago. Yeah, Tony was great. He lives out, and he's a New York guy, but he lives in L.A. also now.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, look it up. It's a great, if you're into that Thundersteel period of Riot, it's a great show. You'll find out like a lot of it's really interesting how he got the gig and everything too.
Yeah, I think that's up there in that realm of another Tony Martin era Sabbath that I also really love. It's like a different Sabbath, but I love like
We do too.
Yeah,
you we do too. Tony Martin fan. Yeah,
yeah.
It drives me nuts that I don't expect him to get the level of love that Dio and Ozzy got, but it's so much lower,
yeah.
You know, what people think of. Unless if the guys that are really plugged into that scene know him and love him, but there's so many people that are just like, oh, that wasn't Black Sabbath, that wasn't Black Sabbath. And, like, you never listen to it. Really, it was Black Sabbath.
I mean, yeah, it's like, how do you choose? Like, people always, there's still people that won't listen to the Dio Sabbath. I'm like, how? Like, but I get it. It's. I think each era of Sabbath, each singer of Sabbath, is like a different band. It's like a different, whole different band. You know, that's how I compartmentalize it, at least.
And I saw them on the Headless Cross tour in.
Oh wow!
Yeah, in fact, we just had one of the guys on from Silent Rage 2 weeks ago, and Silent Rage was the opening band on that tour. And that tour was with Cozy Powell playing drums also. And they were fantastic.
That's amazing.
And I saw Ozzy with Sabbath three times in the 70s and twice with Dio in the early 80s. And when I saw them with Tony Martin, it was right up there. It was great. He was a great live singer too. You sound really, really good. So, yeah, it's funny you mentioned him because he's a big love of both of us.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And, I mean, for me, just being a big Deep Purple and Ian Gillan fan when he did, you know, Born Again, like that was, it like kind of brought all the worlds together for me.
Sure. Yeah.
And you see, I was never a big fan of that record.
Yeah. You know, I think the actual released record isn't as good as like the raw like board mix, like the raw demo mix.
Well, they always said that the mix of that album got all fucked. I think Martin Birch did do the production of it, but there was always issues with it was a weird sounding album. It had,
very weird record.
Yeah. And I always found it to be a weird, you know, I grew up with those bands as a kid when they were in their heyday. And it was just something kind of sacrilegious with seeing him in Sabbath. It was just a weird dynamic. And And it didn't last too. And if you ever hear the story about how that all came about, they met in the bar just by happen chance and got drunk. And it was just, he said, I woke up the next day and I got a phone call from their management and said, hey, you know, welcome aboard. He goes, welcome aboard to what? You're in Black Sabbath. He goes, am I really?
Yeah, exactly.
So before we let you go, we had to, I know Dio is a big influence of yours, and I'm just going to run down Dio and Rainbow. What's your favorite album?
That's a tough one. I think the one I put on the most is it's probably Rising, but it's tough. But yeah, I'd probably have to go with Rising.
For me, Long Live Rock and Roll.
Yeah, that's like, I couldn't choose between the two, but yeah.
Dio and Sabbath, what's your favorite one?
Lately, I've been really loving Dehumanizer.
Wow, really? See, that's another album I never really totally warmed up to. Never really warmed
it's
up.
Got, I don't know why. I just lately I've been really loving it. But then, like, I'll go back and listen to like Mob Rules or something. I'm like, oh yeah, this is
That's my favorite Mob Rules of the Dio and yeah. And the Dio solo period. What was your favorite one?
Yeah, I think I'm just kind of like going to say it's like kind of boring, but Holy Diver, it's like pretty solid for me. It's got a lot of bangers.
And for me, it was the third one, which I know a lot of people hold the first two in such, you know, high regard. But I always, I like the third one a lot. And I like the fourth one, the one that had, who was the guitar player that replaced Vivian? Goldie.
Craig Goldie.
Those two were very big favorites of mine. Sacred Heart.
Yeah. And, Sacred Heart is like pretty close second.
Yeah. It's not quite as heavy as the first two, but the songs are just incredible on it.
I'll tell a really quick story about Sacred Heart. On this last tour, have you heard that band Riot City out of
Oh, Canada? Yeah. A big fan. Huge. Love them.
Yeah. So we played some shows with them. Up in Calgary and after the show we were going to like some party and their bassist Dustin was like he was really wasted giving us directions to this house that they were going to go party at but he was also like really wanted to hear Sacred Heart like the whole time, and then he just started playing it on his phone and singing along in like the back seat, like kind of like quietly, but just singing along. It was just like really hilarious. And we're like, dude, where are we going? Like, right. Which way? He's like, just keep going. We're like, what do you just go straight? I know where I'm at, man. And we're like, okay. And he's like, just follow the Sacred Heart. Follow the Sacred Heart. And
then that's when you know you're in trouble.
Became, yeah. Yeah. That just kind of became our new phrase. Is just follow the Sacred Heart whenever we're trying to find something or lost.
Oh, so you toured with those guys?
We just did one show in Calgary, and then we did a show with what other show did we do? No, Hell's Heroes was a different thing. But
this
yeah.
was with the first singer or the second singer?
This is with the second singer.
Okay, yeah, that guy's pretty insane.
Yeah, Jordan. He
gets up there in the high stratosphere.
Oh yeah, he's great.
And I've seen some live stuff of they're pretty intense live.
Yeah.
Well, you could work on a keep it in mind for a new Entranced album. You could work on a song, you know, Follow the Sacred Heart. There you go.
Yeah.
So is that it?
That's it. I've exhausted myself.
Tom got all his questions.
Awesome, guys. Awesome, guys.
JP, thank you. Appreciate your time tonight. Thanks for talking to us and pulling over on the side of the road and giving us a few minutes.
Of course.
All right.
Mark and Tom, thank you.
All right. Everybody, James Paul Luna from Entranced. Check him out.
Keep in touch.
See ya.
Take care, JP. Bye-bye.